quicken a lot in January after the holidays and as health providers figure out how to optimize their routines. But some of this also involves money. The federal government has poured billions of dollars into developing, manufacturing, and distributing these vaccines, but it has provided very little funding to local healthcare workers who have the enormous task of vaccinating people. Dr. Howard Koh at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health says some significant funding to hire new staff to do just that is finally on the way, thanks to the COVID relief bill that just got signed.
The new congressional package is an excellent down payment, has some $8 billion out of a $900 billion relief package to shore up a public health infrastructure that's been hollowed out for far too long. But the public health systems at the state and local level need much more support going forward if we're going to return to any sense of normal soon.
He's also incensed that some members of the public have been provoked to lash out against public health officials over issues like mask wearing and closing businesses and so on, when in fact the public health system is playing such a vital role in helping us through this pandemic, giving us these vaccines.
Right. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris, thank you.
Anytime.
So what are the implications of the slow rollout and what needs to change? Dr. Paul Offit is one of the experts who advised the FDA during the vaccine approval process. He's also the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and joins me now. Dr. Offit, good morning.
Good morning.
So the U.S. has had two vaccines approved for emergency use for 2 weeks. And as we just heard, the goal was for 20 million people to get their first dose by today. But according to the CDC, we're at about 2.8 million people. So what happens if things continue at this pace?
Right. I mean, first of all, we only have about 12 million doses distributed. It's a two-dose vaccine, which would mean, 6 million people. So we haven't even made enough vaccine to vaccinate 20 million people. So I think two things need to change. One is we need to really ramp up production, which may mean, sort of commandeering a variety of production sites so that more than one or two sites are making this vaccine. Secondly, I think we need to have a plan for distribution that is centers on mass distribution. In other words, that we do this in stadiums and auditoriums and churches and synagogues, that we just line up to give vaccines, which is the only way this can happen. You can't just have people sort of walk into the pharmacy and get it at their convenience. This is going to have to be a mass vaccination campaign.
So you're saying there's not enough vaccine. We're hearing reports of frontline medical workers, especially in rural areas, who were promised a vaccine and are still waiting for their shots. What does this indicate about obstacles at a state and local level?
Right. It's what we're asking to have happen here is that we're asking for 70% of the American population to be vaccinated. There's 330 million people in our country. So if you vaccinate, let's say, 240 million people, that's 480 million doses that you have to get out there. It's hard to do that. I mean, our hospital, I think, has done a very good job at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. We vaccinate 10 to 12 people every 30 minutes. And so we vaccinate 350 people a day. We vaccinated 4,500 people in less than 2 weeks. That's the way to do it. Just, line us up and give us a vaccine. But you can't do that unless there is enough vaccine. And we don't have enough vaccine yet. It's not easy to mass produce vaccines, especially these vaccines, which are in this lipid nanoparticle, which has never been scaled up before. So you can't just snap your fingers and watch it happen. Hopefully, under the next administration, there'll be a real commitment to mass production.
How much of this is about a lack of funding resources?
I think everything's about a lack of funding and resources. I mean, if you look at what we just had this virus in hand, SARS-CoV-2 virus, in January of 2020. That's the first time we knew the sequence of this virus. Within 11 months, we had done two large clinical trials using a novel technology, messenger RNA, that worked extremely well. I mean, and the reason that we were able to do that so quickly is we spent $24 billion to do it. I mean, we'd have made a major Manhattan Project level commitment to do that. I think we have to do the same thing for vaccination. We did it for vaccine. Now we have to do it for vaccination. I'm not sure there's, at least in this administration, the will to do that.
On that note, President Trump recently deflected blame, tweeting, "Now it's up to the states to administer and get moving." How much responsibility for planning and logistics do the states bear, and how much does the federal government bear?
Right. Well, they both bear responsibility. And so the finger pointing doesn't do any good. I mean, we're all in this together. And so let's do what we can do at our best. I mean, we've pulled together in national tragedies before. The World War II was a national tragedy. 9/11 was a national tragedy. These aren't Republican or Democratic issues, and the finger pointing doesn't do any good. Let's figure out how to do this and do it and spend the resources we need to do it. It's just wearing, frankly, just always trying to figure out who to blame.
You know, you mentioned that we're only at a point where people have gotten the first vaccine dose and many people will need their second shot soon. Could this cause even more confusion and further complicate this rollout that's been so slow?
It would be demoralizing. I mean, I'm one of those people who got the first dose and certainly expect the second dose, because the way these studies were done, both by Pfizer and Moderna, was they found that one dose was not good enough, that they didn't induce high levels of virus-specific neutralizing antibodies with a single dose, hence the second dose that was given, depending on the product, 3 or 4 weeks later. Then they got an excellent booster response, and then when they did the big phase 3 trial of tens of thousands of people, they found that it was highly effective. To get one dose is to assume that you have some level of protection, and to assume that that level of protection is relatively long-lasting, both of which might not be true.
President-elect Joe Biden has vowed to administer 100 million vaccine shots during his first 100 days in office. How realistic is that, given what we know about the current challenges?
Well, given the way that we're mass producing the vaccine right now, it seems incredibly unrealistic. I mean, what we're talking about then is having a million doses a day. Right now, we only have 12 million doses, and it's been several weeks. So we definitely have to change the way that we're mass producing and distributing this vaccine. I'm glad he said that. I think it's aspirational. It's good to set a high bar, and hopefully we'll be able to mass produce this in the manner that it needs to be mass produced and then distribute it in the manner it needs to be distributed. But right now, we're doing neither.
Now, Dr. Anthony Fauci recently said 90% of Americans will need to be vaccinated or immune to stop the spread of the coronavirus. That means unifying much of the country behind this vaccination campaign during a very polarized time on even whether to get this vaccine. How do we do that in order for things to return to somewhat normal by the spring or summer?
Right. I think 90% might be high. I mean, this is a vaccine that's 95% effective. So there's a formula for this, for how, depending on the contagiousness of the virus and the effectiveness of the vaccine, probably 70% may be close. Also, remember, we have reported that 20 million people in the United States have been infected. That's just the number of people who've been tested to have been infected. If you look at actually the antibody studies, which is a more sensitive way of figuring out who actually has been infected, that number is probably off by a factor of 3. So in truth, about 60 million people in this country have already been infected. That's 20% of the population. Those people, when they're re-exposed to the virus, are going to be very unlikely to be hospitalized or die. So I think that we're jumping with a little bit of a net. We have about 20% of the population that's already probably at a large level protected against the severe nature of this virus.
In the few seconds that we do have left, the federal government has a distribution partnership with a number of pharmacy chains, including Costco, Walmart, and CVS, to administer vaccines in their stores and other sites. But they haven't launched that effort yet. Will that help if they do launch that?
Yes, definitely it'll help. I mean, where it won't help is in my state, Pennsylvania, you know, there are those regions in the center of the state that are fairly sparsely populated where there may not be a pharmacy nearby. And I'm actually on this committee with our Secretary of Health, Rachel Levine. And what she wants to do is set up, you know, vaccination centers in the same way you would have a testing center in those areas. And that's great. It's a good idea. It's doable. But again, it requires money to do it. So I think this is all comes down to the same thing, which is making a financial commitment in the same way we made a financial commitment to doing the research and development in these vaccines. We need to make a financial commitment to vaccination.
Dr. Offit is a member of the FDA Vaccine Advisory Panel. Thank you again for being with us, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
This is NPR News.
19 past 8 now. This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later this hour, the first Wisconsin Life of 2021, a story about dreaming of winter hibernation. That's in 25 minutes.
Celebrate the season with special programs all this month on WPR. Enjoy holiday tunes on Simply Folk. Hear the Eau Claire Master Singers on Wisconsin Classical. And enjoy Christmas with the Moorhouse and Spelman Glee Clubs. Find a complete schedule of holiday programs at wpr.org/holidays.
Support for WPR comes from Big Brothers Big Sisters, dedicated to creating and supporting one-to-one mentoring relationships that ignite the power and promise of youth. Mentor information and more at bbbs.org.
Support comes from Gateway. The new semester begins January 19th. Although Student Services is closed through the holidays, browse the program catalog and register online now. Starting January 4th, career counselors will be available via phone, email, online chat, or Zoom.
Morning for most of the state, then sunny skies in the northeast, cloudy with flurries for the rest of Wisconsin, and we'll have highs from the mid-20s to around 30. On Saturday, partly sunny, highs around 30 degrees. Sunny skies on Sunday, with highs continued near 30.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. From the Candida Fund, supporting individual dignity and sustainable communities through investments in transformative leaders and ideas. Learn more at kendedafund.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to solve social and environmental problems to improve lives today and benefit future generations. More information at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We have the story of a woman challenging the leader of Cambodia. She is a Cambodian-American lawyer. She returned to her home country, and she is criticizing its authoritarian government, which is why she is preparing for prison. She spoke with reporter Michael Sullivan.
It's always dangerous to criticize Cambodia's Prime Minister Hun Sen. There's a reason he's been in power for 35 years and counting. Terry Singh doesn't much care. She's been a critic for years, though she claims to have recently toned it down.
I'm quiet, but relatively speaking, I'm still, I guess, a pain in the ass for Mr. Hun Sen to a degree.
With a law degree from the University of Michigan, Terry Singh returned to her homeland for good in 2004 and has been a vocal supporter of the opposition, which may help explain why she was among more than 100 people charged with incitement or treason in November. Just before her court date, the University of Michigan and Georgetown-educated activist took a pair of scissors to her long hair and started hacking it off during a live video stream, explaining she was getting ready for prison and prison lice. Prematurely, it turns out, the trial was postponed till later this month.
You know, I like long hair. I look like Peter Pan right now, and even though I'm saving a lot of money on shampoo, which is a good thing, I wanted to communicate with this regime that I do not fear it. And I do not fear facing jail on unjust charges.
But Prime Minister Hun Sen isn't backing down either. Just last week, the government brought charges against several dozen more activists. Over the decades, Hun Sen has steadily squeezed out the opposition, and he's doubled down in the last 3 years, muzzling independent media and dissolving Cambodia's main opposition party.
It's sliding into autocracy in a hurry. And the proverbial elephant in the room is China. I think the Trump administration has really encouraged autocrats like Hun Sen to be more bold and has encouraged China as well.
A China whose influence in Cambodia is growing, most recently with the construction of port facilities in the south of the country, facilities Terry Singh and U.S. officials fear could be used to host Beijing's ships and planes.
I would like to think that concern for Cambodia itself is enough, but I'm not naive. The Cambodia situation should be a concern for the world. China and Cambodia creates regional insecurity and global instability.
But even with all that, she's still hopeful. In part, she says, because the 68-year-old Hun Sen can't live forever.
There are reasonable people within this regime who who are keeping quiet out of practical reasons, for survival's sake, it won't take much for them to change side.
Not necessarily because they believe in democracy, she says, but because they believe it's their turn. Her trial is set to resume later this month. She reckons she has a 50-50 chance of doing time, better than most of her co-defendants, she says, because of her U.S. passport. But she says it doesn't make her immune.
Physical security now is a big concern, in particular when I have to travel, because we have seen before that they use road accidents as a cover-up for many of these cases.
But she's not using her U.S. passport to leave, even though she has family in the States she hasn't seen for years and wanted to connect with over the holidays. I fled Cambodia once as a child, she says, and I'm not doing it again.
Because I fear that if I leave, I would not be able to come back to attend trial, that they would prohibit my return to Cambodia. This is home. No one can force me to leave my home.
For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Bangkok.
This week, we've been asking you, our listeners, what got you through a challenging year. For some of you, it was either discovering or reigniting a creative streak.
Anjali DeSarma is a senior at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She's been working on an acrylic painting for the past 9 months, which helps her recall her recent study abroad.
I'm using this as a way to recall some of the beauty that I saw when I had that freedom of being able to go wherever I wanted.
When she paints, she plays music from the band Beach House in the background. And that time, it's allowed her to find solace in the things that she can control and create.
This should be sort of a time of coming into my own. And one of the things I like the most about making art and about painting is that you have the control of the paintbrush and you have the control of how it'll turn out.
If you're looking for a little more control, DeSarma has some advice.
I would suggest to everyone to sort of be able to put their phone down and just enjoy the feeling of creation.
But unlike DeSarma, siblings Maggie Slepian and Harry Wolfson Slepian needed their phones to give them that nudge to create.
I had one drawing that was a 40-hour drawing that I worked with over FaceTime with Harry for weeks and weeks this summer.
They live more than 2,000 miles away from each other. Maggie lives in Bozeman, Montana, Harry in Somerville, Massachusetts. And after Maggie lost her job early in the pandemic, she and Harry turned to FaceTime so they could draw together.
It was a great opportunity to kill two very important birds with one stone.
Harry says those weekly video calls and drawing sessions brought the siblings closer together.
But how much drawing have we done? We've done so much drawing together.
And how much time have we spent together? A lot.
Maggie says the calls pushed her to draw for the first time in years and made her realize it was something that she missed.
Both of the siblings studied art in college, so this isn't the first time they've drawn together. Maggie remembers those times when she'd return to their family home and go to a museum to sketch together with Harry.
Harry and I feel like have always had a really special connection with art. Reconnecting with that would not have happened without the pandemic.
Those were the voices of Maggie Slepian, Harry Wolfson Slepian, and Anjali DeSarma. They all found solace in art, something they plan to continue into the new year. Tomorrow on Weekend Edition, a conversation with Virginia Chandler, a 95-year-old nursing home resident. She talks about how she's coping with the pandemic and her anticipation of the vaccine. Listen by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. This is NPR News.
2020 put a lot of New Year's resolutions through a wood chipper, but that doesn't mean you should give up on 2021.
Every day is a blank canvas that is being painted on by many more forces than just me, but these are the little marks that I'm going to try to make.
I'm Ari Shapiro. New Year's resolutions for an unpredictable year this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Brady Carlson is your host for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in our newscast, we'll hear about a new role for drones in Wisconsin, helping geologists find shallow soils in areas sensitive to groundwater contamination. Details of that story after an update from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Barbara Klein. Los Angeles County says a surge in COVID-19 patients is forcing ambulances to wait up to 8 hours to offload them. And Hedy Lynn Hurdies reports patients aren't the only ones at risk.
The long lines are detrimental for the ambulance crew as well. Director of the County Emergency Medical Services Agency, Kathy Chittister, says crews aren't able to get back in the field to respond to other emergencies when they're stuck in the hospital bay. Speaking to reporters, Chittister said they're running out of ambulances, leading to longer and longer response times to 911 calls. With hospital workers overwhelmed, there's no doubt, she adds, we are in the midst of a disaster. For NPR News, I'm Hedy Lynn Hurdies in Los Angeles.
Britain is now economically divorced from the European Union. New restrictions and paperwork for travel and trade are now taking effect. French President Emmanuel Macron addressed Brexit in his New Year's Eve address last night. Rebecca Rossman is in the northern port city of Calais.
He said, you know, that the UK will always remain a friend and neighbor to France. But Brexit was the child of a European malaise and lies. So he also made this appeal to French citizens, you know, to really stick with Europe. And the people I've been speaking to here in Calais agree with Macron.
The UK and EU split politically almost a year ago. This is NPR.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Authorities have arrested a suburban Milwaukee pharmacist suspected of deliberately ruining hundreds of doses of coronavirus vaccine by removing it from refrigeration for 2 nights. The Grafton Police Department said the former Advocate Aurora Health pharmacist was arrested on suspicion of reckless endangerment, adulterating a prescription drug, and criminal damage to property. He is currently being held in the Ozaukee County Jail. Police did not identify the pharmacist, saying he hasn't been formally charged. Advocate Aurora Healthcare Chief Medical Group Officer Jeff Barr says the pharmacist deliberately removed 57 vials containing hundreds of doses of the Moderna vaccine from refrigeration overnight on December 24th, returned them, then left them out again the night of December 25th. Police estimate the value of the spoiled doses to be between $8,000 and $11,000. The FBI and U.S. Food and Drug Administration are also investigating the case. Geologists have been testing drones in northeastern Wisconsin as a way to pinpoint shallow soils in areas sensitive to groundwater contamination. Their use may speed up efforts to comply with restrictions on manure spreading that were approved 2 years ago. Danielle Kading reports.
Studies in northeastern Wisconsin have shown private wells are vulnerable to groundwater contamination from nitrates and other bacteria due to thin soils. County conservationists have been working with farms to pinpoint areas where manure spreading is restricted due to shallow soils. Hydrogeologist David Hart with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey says they're using drones equipped with thermal cameras.
What we've seen is that there's a pretty marked temperature difference where you have really thin soils and then where the soils get thicker.
Hart says the hope is that drones will be faster than collecting data on the ground. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A coal-fired ferry that carries people and cars across Lake Michigan between Michigan and Wisconsin has been sold. The Ludington Daily News reports that Interlake Holding Company announced Wednesday that it bought the SS Badger. The 410-foot Badger launched in 1952. It hauled rail cars on the Great Lakes from 53 to 1990. It was converted into a car and passenger ferry that can carry 600 people and 180 vehicles. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from ServPro. With ServPro emergency ready profiles to minimize business interruption after a disaster. At 1-800-SERVPRO or servpro.com/NPR. ServPro, like it never even happened. And from C3. C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at c3.ai.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. We have a brand new year, which begins with the very same economy that we had yesterday. But what are the trend lines for 2021? NPR Chief Economic Correspondent Scott Horsley joins us. Scott, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Steve. So where to go but up.
Yeah, there we go. We begin the year with vaccines being distributed, not as quickly as expected, but millions of shots are out there. What's that do for the economy?
Well, it does mean things are looking up. The folks at the Federal Reserve now say they think the U.S. economy is going to grow more than 4% in 2021. They think by the end of this year, unemployment will have fallen from 6.7% now to around 5%. Both those forecasts are rosier than what the Fed was expecting just a few months ago. There was also a survey by the National Association for Business Economics that finds growing optimism. Nearly 3 out of 4 business economists surveyed think the economy will have regained all the ground it lost in 2020 sometime by the second half of this coming year.
The second half of this coming year. But in this first half that's beginning, we clearly still don't have a handle on the pandemic.
No, I mean, we're still losing more than 3,000 people every day in this country. We've lost more than 340,000 Americans so far to the virus. That's an enormous human as well as economic loss. And because so many people are still getting sick, we are seeing more restrictions imposed on in-person businesses. Consumers themselves are also getting more careful about going out and shopping and spending money. We also know now that there's a new variation of the virus here in the U.S. that appears to spread more easily, and that could lead to, you know, more restrictions still. It is encouraging that we have these highly effective vaccines that were developed at warp speed, but so far the shots are getting out there at a much slower speed, more like a local subway.
Yeah.
You know, President-elect Joe Biden has set a goal of delivering 100 million shots in his first 100 days in office. Right now, we're doing about 200,000. So unless there's a sharp acceleration, 200,000 a day, excuse me.
Yeah.
So it's going to take a really sharp acceleration to get anywhere close to the kind of speed that Biden is talking about. In the meantime, public health officials say it's even more important that people keep wearing their face masks, keep their distance from other people, and keep washing their hands.
So this becomes the critical factor for so many businesses. If you're working in the restaurant industry, if you're running a movie theater, if you work in the airlines, anything like that, you've got hazards ahead. Other parts of the economy, I guess, would be less affected, just as was the case in 2020.
That's right. This has been a really uneven recession and a really uneven recovery, both for individuals and for whole industries. People who can work from home and have a job that's in demand might be doing just fine. A lot of factories are now back to near pre-pandemic levels. They've been able to keep their workers spaced out, and they're making products that people are buying. Consumers are actually buying a lot of stuff right now. In some cases, they're spending more on goods because they can't spend money on services like eating out or traveling or going to concerts. Service businesses, though, and the people who work in those industries, the businesses that depend on bringing people together, they're still suffering. We could, however, see a fairly rapid turnaround in services once people actually feel safe going out in crowds again. During the hunker down, some people have actually managed to put some money aside, and that pent-up demand could come unpent once the virus is under control.
Where's the stock market headed?
It has been a wild ride. We had a gut-wrenching plunge during the spring of 2020 when the pandemic first took hold in the U.S., but since that time, stocks have made up all the lost ground and then some. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed yesterday at a record high. It was up more than 7% from the beginning of 2020. The S&P 500 grew more than 16% last year. Some of that was driven by big technology stocks that profited from our stay-at-home lifestyles during the pandemic, Netflix and Amazon, for example. But some of the recent gains have also come from more consumer stocks and even beaten down industries like cruise ships. So investors are betting that the worst is now behind us and that 2021 will be brighter. Let's hope that's true of the broader economy as well.
Whatever happens, NPR Chief Economic Correspondent Scott Horsley will be around to tell us about it. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The enigmatic rapper MF Doom has died. He emerged mysteriously onto the New York scene in the late 1990s and became a cult figure in the underground rap world. NPR's Andrew Limbong confirmed his death with his former business partner. He has this remembrance.
MF Doom was as close as you could get to an actual supervillain. He was a recluse, went by an alias, and kept his face hidden behind a mask before we all had to start doing it. And the hard-to-explain mythology he created was part of the appeal. Take, for instance, the 2003 record Vaudeville Villain. Victor the director, flip a script like Rob Reiner. The way a lot of dudes rhyme, their names should be Knob Shiner. The album is credited to Victor Vaughn, who, according to the mythology, is not MF Doom, but a reflection of him. Here's how he explained it to NPR in 2003.
Say you are, you know how you have Superman, and then you got Bizarro. Supposed to be like Superman's equal in an alternate universe type of thing. So Victor's from that alternate universe. That's no ditty, born so witty.
The way you take no prisoners is show no pity. MF Doom was born Daniel Dumoulin in London in 1971. He was raised in New York and started rapping under the name Zev Love X, and with his brother formed the group KMD. Even in those early years, you could hear his fascination with rhyme. On the hills of my chinny chin chin, got many plus plenty. String by string, I think I count like 20. If you loan me. KMD was on the rise when his brother was hit by a car and died. Upset and disenchanted with the music industry, Dumoulin retreated from public view until he came back, this time as MF Doom, sporting a metal mask reminiscent of Dr. Doom from Marvel Comics, and proudly declaring himself a villain. Definition supervillain, a killer who loved children, one who was well skilled in destruction as well as building. He told NPR in that 2003 interview that he loved playing characters.
I'm an author. I'm writing a story. I'm going to make it interesting enough every time. Even if I got to switch characters, whatever. It ain't all about me.
He leaned so much into the MF Doom character offstage, he was known for sending in imposter MF Dooms, known as Doombots, to perform as him at shows. Now, all of this might seem a little gimmicky, but his talent stringing together rhyming words, pulling in assorted pop culture references while maintaining multi-layered storylines was undeniable. Who shot you? Who got you? New spots to vandal. Do not stand still. Boast your skills close, but no krills. Post for polils. Post no bills. Coast to coast. Joe Smoes flows ill. Go chill. Not supposed to overdose. No dose pills. He was a rapper also beloved by other rappers. You can find videos of Tyler the Creator and Earl Sweatshirt fanboying out over meeting him, Mos Def late night in studio relishing over his favorite MF Doom lines. And there's a 2017 episode of Hannibal Buress' podcast Handsome Rambler where the rapper Talib Kweli talks about touring with Doom and taking him aside to ask about the imposters.
He said, "I'm the supervillain. I'm not your friend.
He never said
you
he
don't
was,
have to yeah. like me. I'm yeah. the villain."
MF Doom might have played a villain, but he was a hero to rappers. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, 8:42 right now. This fall, the bluegrass supergroup Sister Sadie became the first all-female band ever to win the top prize, Entertainer of the Year, at the International Bluegrass Music Association Awards. We'll trace their long journey to recognition in 9 minutes.
Hi, I'm Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you to the more than 50,000 individuals and families and more than 500 business sponsors who supported WPR with a gift last year. With your generosity, people all over Wisconsin can enjoy and rely on daily information and inspiration. Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Support for WPR comes from the DNR's eCycle Wisconsin program, reminding listeners that many electronics cannot be put in the trash and should be recycled. Collection sites at dnr.wi.gov. Search eCycle.
Support comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering an online master's degree in applied biotechnology. Discover, research, and thrive in the expanding field of biotech in partnership with UW Extension. Details at uwp.edu.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. The staff at Piasecki Funeral Home can help you plan a meaningful funeral or memorial service. They consider it an honor to serve families in their community. Since 1931, KenoshaFuneralHome.com.
Hall of the Musikverein in Vienna. That's coming up at 10 this morning. Here's what the weather forecast looks like on the first day of 2021. Some dense freezing fog this morning for much of the state. Then sunny skies in the northeast, cloudy with flurries for the rest of Wisconsin, highs from the mid-20s to around 30. On Saturday, partly sunny, highs around 30 degrees, and sunny skies on Sunday with highs continued near 30.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at metamucil.com/2-week-challenge. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting those working towards a day when no one has to choose between paying rent, putting food on the table, and protecting their health and the health of others. rwjf.org.
It's 8:45 now, time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a dream about hibernation. The story was written a couple of years ago, but in the midst of the pandemic, it may be more relevant than ever.
Some animals hibernate to survive the winter. Humans aren't included in that group, but that hasn't stopped writer Krista Eastman from imagining her perfect winter abode.
Before natural historians understood that some birds fly thousands of miles south each winter, they looked for other ways to explain their disappearance. Birds were like snakes, they suggested, burrowing for themselves a hibernaculum, an earthy pocket in which to pass the winter. Under the ground, the robin slumbered, her heart beating once in a while, her open throat not tweeting at all, her feathers caked in grit. This was another way to survive the winter, digging in, admitting no one, waiting for this too to pass. Deep into the winter blues, I awake to early morning darkness and wonder, is there really no other place for people and animals to live? Is there no other way? Some people are practical in coping with the season. Swift in booking cheap flights to Florida, they do not hesitate, they do not dally, they just depart. I am a member of that other tribe, those who dig in, those who let their thoughts grow warped on the grayest light of winter. At some point, usually around January 14th, I surrender to the season. My most insignificant problems begin to appear to me as uncontainable irritations, crosswords I'm much too grumpy to solve. It's hard, then, not to fantasize about my own hibernaculum, how I'd stock mine with a 5-month supply of coffee, chocolate, cheese, and wine to be consumed in that order every day, all winter long. Add to that a pile of books and a landline that only dials out for delivery. This would be the season of slow and silent contemplation, moderate melancholy, little to no exercise. A wise friend of mine claims this is what winter is for, a natural slowing down, a time to reflect, a not-so-unhealthy space for feeling a little bit sad. If it were possible, I think I'd also loft my hibernaculum in a tree and make of it a warm and protected nest. And then I'd also probably appoint someone responsible for yanking open the nest trap door once spring had truly come. I'd fall to the ground in an unwashed heap, stand up, blink my eyes. I imagined then that my pitying neighbors would gather round to watch as I stood for the first time in months, stretching muscles, cracking joints. "She smells even worse than last year," one of them might mutter, as I crab walk off to the lake for a bracing spring rinse. But I won't do any of that, of course, not really. I will climb out of bed when my son wakes each morning. I will be on time for work. I will remember to bring home that carton of eggs. But someday I will also emerge vainglorious from winter's pocket, It will be suddenly warm, and I will be suddenly awake, and soon, my naked ankles frisky from sun, I'll wonder, what could be better than here? What way is there but this?
Krista Eastman's essays have appeared in the Georgia Review, the Kenyon Review, and other journals. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org and find us on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you're in Janesville or surrounding communities, you can now hear the Ideas Network on WPR's newest station, 100.3 FM. Find your nearest station anytime at wpr.org/maps.
Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on WPR. In sports, the Wisconsin men's basketball team beat Minnesota yesterday 71-59. The Wisconsin women lost to Michigan 92-49. The Marquette men are scheduled to play Georgetown tomorrow. The Marquette women play DePaul on Sunday. The Bucks host the Chicago Bulls tonight, and the Packers play the Bears on Sunday. This morning, some dense freezing fog for most of the state, then sunny skies in the northeast. It'll be cloudy with flurries for the rest of Wisconsin, highs from the mid-20s to around 30, partly sunny on Saturday, with highs right around 30 degrees.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. The band Sister Sadie made history in 2020. They became the first group made up entirely of women musicians to win the bluegrass industry's top award. Julie Height of member station WNXP retraces their long journey to recognition.
If there's one thing that counts in the bluegrass world, no matter how adventurous you get musically, it's the ability to play in a traditional style with real command and gusto.
Deanie plays with as much fire and passion as anybody who'd ever picked up a fiddle. Tina's got the killer rhythmic chop and perfect leads and feels that fit the song. And Gina is a rototiller on the banjo.
That was guitarist Dale Ann Bradley praising her fellow founding members of Sister Sadie, fiddler Deanie Richardson, mandolinist Tina Adair, and banjo player Gina Britt. Britt, Bradley, and Adair are no slouches in the singing department either.
Well, I'll pawn you my watch, pawn you my chain, pawn you my gold and diamond. If this train run me right, I'll be home by tomorrow night. 'Cause I'm 900 miles from my home.
Even the band members' backgrounds reflect traditional notions of where bluegrass comes from. Bradley, Britt, Richardson, and Adair grew up learning the music from their elders in the tiny towns and rural hollers of North Carolina, Alabama, Tennessee, and Kentucky. Bradley, the one who hails from the bluegrass state, had the most rustic upbringing of all. No running water until her senior year of high school.
Things hadn't changed up in that holler or this part of the country. Might be a few more cars, maybe.
They were each getting out of town plenty by the mid-1990s, when they began to occasionally cross paths on the regional bluegrass circuit. Adair traveled with her family's band as a kid.
I remember seeing Deanie
I was just a little girl and Deanie was a teenager and just wearing it out and winning competitions and stuff like that.
They were all pretty young when they started performing, which is common in bluegrass. But they'd built up long resumes and a vast shared repertoire of songs by the time they and original bassist Beth Lawrence got together for a casual one-off gig at Nashville Station Inn in 2012.
We were trying to add it up. Lord, there was over 100 years of playing experience between all of us, I think, you know.
When Adair and the others were immediately asked to play more shows, they decided to pool all of that experience for real and start making albums. Some of them had been in all-female bluegrass lineups before, but they'd all logged more time in co-ed situations. And they were well aware that, especially in traditional circles, the supergroup they'd formed under the name Sister Sadie was a departure from the gendered norm.
This is definitely a male-dominated genre business.
Deanie Richardson.
There were females back in the beginning, of course, but it's been mainly male-dominated.
But Gina Britt says that she and her bandmates have forged a robust connection with their audiences by being who they are.
We're just real. We're 40-something-year-old women. I'm a mom of two teenage daughters. We also have full-time jobs. I actually work at a bank. I work at a Farm Credit as a loan assistant. So I think a lot of people connect with us, and they see that we're real, and I just think that's a big part of it.
Humor is a big part of their onstage dynamic. Adair has cracked up many a crowd, spinning mundane details into down-home yarns and one-liners.
We're working on a sponsorship with Depends, just so y'all know, if anybody cared.
She's not afraid to say anything.
That's Richardson again.
You know, most people, for the most part of the world that we play in, is pretty conservative. And Tina can push some boundaries there, so I never know what she's going to say, and I love it.
So does everyone who comes to see them at the shows they book themselves without an agent or a manager.
In my mama's house, in my mama's room, we would dream about all the
In 2019, their three-part harmonies won them the Vocal Group of the Year Award from the International Bluegrass Music Association. That was a first for an all-woman lineup and a big deal in a genre that idealizes virile, high and lonesome singing. In 2020, Sister Sadie followed up with the ultimate win, Entertainer of the Year, becoming the first band entirely made up of women to be recognized as the most fully rounded performers in their field. Richardson, who also became the IBMA's first female fiddle player of the year, explains the meaning of the big trophy.
You know, in bluegrass music, there's not the big light show and the big jumping from ropes and swinging around. We're singing about lying and cheating and murder and love and babies and you know, we're singing about our lives. And I feel like the Entertainer Award is about, you know, how you as a band are reaching to that audience. And for us, it's just, you know, we're five women up there who work hard and who live the songs we sing, you know, and play from the depths of our guts. And I think that comes across.
That momentum is carrying the band into a new phase, with Bradley shifting her focus back to solo work and a new bass player on board, Hazy Siako, who, Deanie Richardson emphasizes, is Sister Sadie's bridge to a new year and a new generation of women.
She's young, she's in her late 20s, and here she is with these late 40s, 50-year-old women out there. For her to be here, a part of this thing now, is just, oh, it pumps me up. It gets me fired up to just do more.
For NPR News, I'm Julie Hyde in Nashville.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music is inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Melissa Ingalls. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Special thanks to John Davis, who keeps the news flowing in the morning. To follow developments throughout the day, visit WPR.org. It's a minute before 9 now. Classical music is just ahead.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Earl M. Terry Endowment Fund, a permanent endowment that provides ongoing support to sustain the present and future operation of Wisconsin Public Radio.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Matheson Memorial Library is launching a new online program just for adults entitled Master of Minutes via the Beanstack app. Registration begins on January 1st. Visit elkhorn.beanstack.org/reader365.
WGTD is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR, a cultural asset and a community resource